This is Kevin Harlan. This Friday, the NBA on Prime crew and I are back with another exciting Emirates NBA Cup doubleheader. First, Bam Adebayo and the Heat take on Jalen Brunson and the Knicks. Then, Steph Curry and the Warriors square off against Wemby and the Spurs. If you're not a Prime member, just sign up for a free 30-day trial. Heat Knicks, Warriors Spurs. Coverage starts Friday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, only on Prime. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App AOK Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App AOK Navida downloaden und loslegen. AOK Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Will they find a home? Sponsored by Geico. Jane doesn't mind an apartment with no elevator.
5 flights of stairs is 5 plates of cardio.
Bob is a little less enthusiastic about stairs.
I hate stairs.
Compromise is tough, but these two won't have to compromise when they bundle renters and car insurance with Geico. It's easy, and they could save even more. In the end, Jane and Bob found an apartment that's a 4-story walk-up. And Bob?
Yeah, there's a freight elevator she doesn't know about.
What were you talking about?
Nothing.
Bundling without compromise at Geico.com.
From the basement of the Bob and Tom Studios, it's That Josh Arnold Podcast. Well, hello. It is me, That Josh Arnold, here to visit again. Oh, man, oh, man. Last week of June. July 4th coming up. Ah, I do love the 4th of July. It's my favorite holiday. And you know what, though? I think we'll talk about that after the fact. Yeah. And I can tell you maybe why it's my favorite holiday, all that kind of thing. So, in the meantime, there's no reason to delay getting to this week's guest. Boy. Just a stellar human being, and I certainly am excited for this guest to be here. Guest this week, it's you! That's right, you, of course. My gosh, how are you? You look good. I hope you're feeling good as well. I am doing well myself. Coming off of a terrific weekend in Lexington, Kentucky, where I did stand-up comedy for the first time in like 16 months. At the wonderful Comedy Off-Broadway Comedy Club. Man, I just love that place for so many reasons. And, boy, maybe reasons one and two in no particular order. The audiences and the staff. I mean, everybody that works at that place is just wonderful. And the audiences are incredible. Just nice and fun and ready to enjoy themselves. And I tell you what, it was really something being out and about with large groups of people again. It was really cool. And I was nervous. I was nervous about doing comedy after such a long hiatus and, you know, shy of a few stutters and stammers here and there. I, for the most part, remembered my act and got to try out a couple new things. I did. Man, a Sunday when I was driving from Lexington back home, I realized that there were like three new jokes that I really wanted to try, and I forgot to try them all weekend. So I will have to do that the next time I'm on stage, which right now won't be until October, but I am certain that more shows will fill, that the calendar will fill in the next couple months, you know, with dates sooner than October. So you can always, it's not updated right now, but maybe by the time you're listening to this, it will be. Go to my website, which is thatjosharnold.com, and I will have my tour schedule up. So again, if you go right, give me like a day, all right? I need to remember how to log into my website and edit things in there, so it may take me a little bit. But, and I also always post my dates on Instagram. And, man, thank you so much to everybody who came out and saw me at Comedy Off-Broadway in Lexington, Kentucky. You were wonderful. I met many, many great people. Luke, it was good seeing you, and I hope your jaw is healing up nicely. Some of you may be wondering what I'm talking about. That's between Luke and I, all right? There may have been an altercation, and but he is healing up, so... And so many others, man, Thomas and Gary and so many great people. If I'm not mentioning your name, Chels, I please do not be offended. If we met and you told me about how much you listen and I'm not naming your name, it's not that I didn't love meeting you. I just have the memory of a fruit fly. So I will try to be better at that. So anyway, great time. More shows coming up in the future. And I am excited. My interest in stand-up is and my love of it alive and well. So this week's sponsor is also all about joy and fun and enjoying yourself. Oh, I'm so proud to have this sponsor on board this week. Toys. That's right, toys. Where would we be in the world without toys? What would we play with?
Hey, I know. Watch yourself, all right? That's not this. Look, I get a little salty on the big show. I try to keep the podcast a little more family friendly.
But yes, toys. Ugh. What do you do when you're bored? And you want a little bit of whimsy and happiness in your life. You pick up a toy, don't you? And you play with it. Man, oh man. Remember how important toys were when you were a kid? I mean, it's all you want. It was all you were focused on, really. Like, what's the next toy I can get and play with? And just watching toy commercials when you're growing up. You got a bowl of cereal there watching Saturday morning cartoons, and you, man, oh, man, just how awesome those toys looked. And then when you got them, like at Christmas or your birthday or whatever, just you couldn't believe it. Oh, and adults have toys, too, but that maybe that'll be a sponsor for another time, the adult toy. So, anyway, down here, thank you, Toys, for sponsoring, and I hope you get to enjoy a toy or two very, very soon. Down here in the basement, I gotta be honest, it's muggy, isn't it, Jason? Man, oh man, hot and humid, but such is a basement in the summertime. Boy, even the daddy long legs are wiping their brows. Is that cute? Is that a cute little image? A daddy long leg, maybe pulling a handkerchief out and mopping his brow. And is it true? Is the whole thing about daddy long legs true? That they're like incredibly venomous, but their mouths are too small to bite humans? Like I've always heard from different people, but I've never bothered to look it up. And I guess I will. I guess I could have before I even brought it up, but I didn't know I was going to bring it up. So give me a break, will you? So apparently, daddy long legs, I've been caught being wrong. I've been wrong so much lately that okay. So what I've heard is that daddy long legs are very, very, like they're one of the more venomous spiders to humans. But they can't bite us. Their teeth or their fangs or whatever, they can't penetrate our skin. Their mouths are just way too small. It seems unlikely to me that, I don't know. I'll look it up, which I need to start doing. Apparently, I was, I'll be honest, I am occasionally wrong on this podcast, and I'm occasionally wrong on the big show, and... Sometimes when I'm wrong, it never bothers me to be corrected because I want to learn. But what does bother me is when the information I have was given to me by a learned person, particularly somebody who is supposed to teach,
like is that I feel taught me something, and then when I share that, it ends up being incorrect. That does bother me. And something happened on the morning on the Bob and Tom show recently where I was wrong because I was taught wrong. And I still want to be corrected. Don't get me wrong. But it bums me out that I was taught incorrectly. So in this specific case, we were talking about like people being hypnotized or sleepwalking or something because I brought up the word somnambulist. And somnambulism is essentially sleepwalking, but in a way where you're sort of suggestive. So, what movie is that? Is it the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari? Like it's this really old sort of one of the first horror movies where I think it is. This doctor, Dr. Caligari has a somnambulist to do his evil bidding for him. So it's this sort of man in a trance who goes and kills for the doctor. And I remember we watched that movie in college when I was going to school in London for a semester at Regent's College. And our professor, who's a really nice guy, he was this old British cinephile, and he loved movies, and he talked, it was about film appreciation or something, and he talked a lot about them. He was telling us about the movie and then mentioned somnambulism, and he said somnambulism and somnambulist, and all that, that's where the word zombie comes from. So som becomes zom, and then it just becomes short, so zombie. And I thought, oh my gosh, how cool is that? And I have been spreading that information every now and again, and I did it recently on the Bob and Tom show. And a windbag wrote in saying, well, that's not correct. And I thought, what? And I looked it up, and my gosh, it isn't really correct. Now, zombie, which I assumed before the professor mentioned the somnambulist thing, I always assumed it was like some old, maybe like tribal word from like a voodoo, like that kind of thing, like that it was an old, and it turns out it kind of is. I think it's African in nature, it means like snake god or something, and a few other things. Now, the American zombie, the American idea of a zombie, somnambulism does kind of come into play in certain movies and stuff like that with zombieism, but the word did not come from somnambulism. So I was wrong and I was taught wrong. And that, yeah, but happy to share the new info for you. How did this start? Where was I? I don't remember. Let's just get out of here. Let's hop on board the TJA Express. That's right. The Arntrack, the world's only steam-powered monorail, takes us out, brings us back. Ah, boy, we are a-cruising, and it feels good, doesn't it? Boy, it's hot out, but that breeze is nice, and here we are. My gosh, Vocabville, it's always a pleasure to be here. You know what, though? I see that we may have overshot Vocabville a little bit, and we're sort of in between Vocabville and learn how to speak, which is more of a segment and not so much a place. But I think you see what I'm trying to do here. Well, you will after I explain today's word, which was sent in. It's a word that it's a thing I'm familiar with, but I thought it would be a lot of fun to talk about because it's you never really hear about it. And Greg wrote in saying, hey, I've got a great vocab word that I thought you'd like to share. He'd never heard of it before. And I only have because I took linguistics classes and stuff in college. And so that's probably the only people who are kind of aware of this, or maybe some computer programmers. But anyway, the word itself, and it is grammar related. So I am, not so much grammar related as it is like punctuation related. So it kind of falls into learn how to speak or learn how to write, that sort of thing. The word is interrobang. Interrobang, which sounds like something pretty awful. It sounds like something that might happen in a James Bond porno parody. So the interrobang is a punctuation mark. Now, it's never used, all right? But I think it should be, and I have theories as to why it isn't. What it is it kind of looks like a capital P with the line, the stem of the P, having a dot underneath it. So, essentially what it is, it's a combination question mark and exclamation point. And it's meant to take the place of that thing we all do when we're trying to write excitedly and but in question form, like, did you really go on a date Saturday night? Question mark, exclamation point, that kind of thing. Or who ate the last of the cookie cake? Question mark, exclamation point. This is meant to be one punctuation mark that means an excited question, that sort of thing. You can't believe, disbelief. So the interrobang, man, if I remember correctly, again, I could have done a little bit more research, but I'm just going based on a college class from 20 years. I think it was like introduced in the 50s or 60s, something like that. And it was on a few typewriters, but it never really made its way to computer keyboards. Now, look, it might be on like some models out there or whatever. But I think now if you want to use an interrobang, you have to go to, I've seen them on some character palettes, meaning like if you go in your iPhone and you've got all those emojis and weird flags. Well, they're weird to me. They're not weird to the people who live under them, but they and all those odd characters in interrobang, maybe in though, like it's sometimes it's like in on some kind of menu or character palette on whatever program you're using. So the reason that it didn't take off is because it was never embraced enough to be put on keyboards like every other punctuation mark, essentially. So if it had been an easy if all you had to do was hit shift interrobang, I think people would have used it a lot more. It's also not the easiest thing to handwrite. So because you essentially make the question mark and then add a little bit to the stem, but not totally to the top of the curve. I know this is hard it's a weird thing. So it's almost like a poorly constructed capital P with a dot underneath it. Strange. But in my opinion, it would look better than a question mark exclamation point. I don't like double punctuation. I don't like when people write me and there are two exclamation points, like they text me and there are two exclamation points after a sentence. Because first off, you just need the one. It really does the trick, all right? I know that you're excited or happy or whatever. First off, the exclamation point is insanely overused. But here's the problem. I think now, and actually I think there have been studies about this, that the exclamation point, if let's say you say, hey, I'm looking forward to seeing you this weekend, if I text that without an exclamation point, people don't believe me. They don't believe it. Or they think you're being sarcastic or something. Like, there have been studies on this. So now everything has an exclamation point behind it, and it's totally unnecessary. So, but yeah, doubling it up. Now, if you're going to get really, really excited and you feel like you have to use more than one exclamation point for whatever reason, in my head, I have decided that three is okay, and that's it. Don't use two. Don't use four. If you're going to use multiple exclamation points, it has to be three. For some reason, three works for me. It doesn't, but I would prefer you to use one, and many times I'd prefer you not to use one at all. But use three. I remember reading the Amityville Horror for the first time, which is kind of a divisive horror novel. Fun, yes. True, probably not. And therefore, less fun than you initially think it is, at least in my opinion. But it's written in a very almost like childish way at times, where the last sentence of chapters, and it happens more than once, ends with a sentence and an exclamation point. So it'll be like, she was in the bedroom, and then she looked, and staring back at her were two red eyes, and it had an exclamation point. It's like, all right, there are better ways to write suspense and scary things. You don't. It just felt very sophomoric to me. So, yeah, but it's an interesting thing, the Interabang. You know, I can't recommend that you use one this week because nobody would really know what you're talking about. But how about this? Mention the Interabang to somebody and ask if they would be pro or anti-Interabang. I'm pro-Interabang, but that's a tall order to get society to go from the exclamation point question mark to the Interabang. I don't think it's going to happen, especially if it's not readily available on all of our keyboards. So, I liked this visit. I hope you did too. I'm a nerd, so I enjoy stuff like this. Let's go ahead and get this train a-rollin' on and see where our next stop is. Oh, how beautiful it is outside. Look at that. Ah, yes. The Japanese maples are in bloom. Oh!
Mr. Right, but he is certainly Mr. Smooth.
That was a little while ago, though.
Was it?
Televilla! That's where we are. Televilla. That's right, where we discuss some of our favorite television shows. And this is one that I've been watching for the last, oh, I don't know. I think I started it in the winter sometime. And it has many, many seasons. And I'm on season, what am I on? Season 7 now, I think. And I'm not a big binger. If I get into a show, I typically, if it's like a show that's been around for years, I'll watch an episode or two a day, that kind of thing. I can't sit down and watch 8 hours worth or whatever. I've got other things I'd also like to do. So, but when it's a show like Mayor of Easttown or something like that, that only has 7 episodes, yeah, I think that took me 2 days. I went ahead and watched 4, and then I watched 3 the next day. So, but this one, it's a very popular show, and I came to the party way late because I kind of assumed, yeah, you know, I assumed that it was like every other television police procedural that, quite frankly, that old people enjoy. I remember my grandma would have loved this show. I remember watching a lot of police procedurals with her. And when I was a kid, I'd be staying over there, you know, at times. And I used to think, God, why does she like these boring cop shows? But I kind of grew to like them too. Now I love them. And this is one that I now love. And I bet many of you watch it. Some of you are going to scoff at me a little bit, but that's okay. It's not for everybody because it is kind of your run of the mill police procedural, main network show. Blue Bloods is what I'm talking about. You know it. The one with Tom Selleck and his mustache and Donnie Wahlberg and some other really, really fine actors. I am enjoying the heck out of Blue Bloods. It's, it's nothing like some of your deeper police or detective shows, and it can be formulaic and it can be unrealistic, but it's really entertaining. And one of my favorite things about it is it stays topical, but every time
that they address something sort of topical, they always share different viewpoints. So if you watch a lot of Law & Order, particularly later seasons of Law & Order SVU, they have gotten fairly preachy where, like, everyone, if there's like a topical thing or whatever, you can tell where the writers and even actors and producers stand politically on that issue, because almost every character is like a mouthpiece for the behind. You can just tell that it's the behind the scenes people who are actually speaking. It's not always the characters. With Blue Bloods, they will show a situation, and then through something which I think is really nice, the characters in the show, it's about a family of law enforcement, essentially. Tom Selleck plays the police chief of New York City, of Manhattan, and his dad was also chief of police and is now retired. And his Tom Selleck's sons are both cops. One is a beat cop, the other is a detective. And then his daughter is an ADA, so she works on the law side of it. The legal side of it, I should say. And they address issues. So what they do is every episode, they have dinner every Sunday together as a family. And every episode shows a part of that dinner. And they discuss something that's, you know, one of the situations that a police officer in the family is dealing with or something like that. So, for instance, they'll say, hey, this guy accidentally, or this guy was being charged by a suspect was charging him, and he was holding a knife, and the police officer shot him. Should the police officer have shot that man, or because his hands were raised, that kind of thing, or should he not have shot him, even though he was holding a knife? It's complicated, real world scenarios. But the thing about it is, when they discuss it at dinner, and they're discussing, everyone has kind of a different viewpoint. Now, there might be two or three characters that agree on something, but they really look at all sides of a situation. And I think you guys know me well enough to know that I love trying to look at a topic at all sides. I think it's important. I think it's totally necessary. I think it's vital that when you are watching the news or you're talking to somebody, that you always try to hear the other person's side and really try to respect where they're coming from. I think it's a lost, it's something that just doesn't happen that much anymore. And I think this show is very thoughtful. And I mean that in the most simplest terms of that word. It's thought-provoking. They put a lot of thought into different sides of arguments, and they put them all out there so that the viewer can decide for themselves. I really, really love that aspect of Blue Bloods. Now, you could say, well, Tom Selleck being the essentially the lead and charming as hell and likable and all that stuff, what he thinks, an audience may tend to walk away with his opinion because he is sort of the main figure of the show. Not always. So I can see where where you'd be coming from, but I don't think that's what they're trying to do. They're not trying to force anybody's agenda on an audience. They're really trying to present all sides, and it's really cool. It's also highly entertaining. It's really good. Some good humor in there, some really warm people that you like being around, and it gets pretty emotional at times and suspenseful at others, and it's good stuff. So, Blue Bloods, I just wanted to let you guys know, I really, really dig that show, and I'm working on a Tom Selleck impression of him in Blue Bloods, but I couldn't ever do it anywhere. It's not his voice. It's not him talking. But in like every episode, he does what I call mustache acting. So like his mustache is actually quite emotive.
So when he is really pondering an issue or thinking about something or worried, he often stares out the window of his high office at 1PP and kind of purses his lips and he really lets his mustache do the talking. And I've nailed that impression, but I just can't. Where the hell am I going to do it? So, maybe check that out. And if you do watch it, I hope you enjoy it. If you hate it, hey, that's all right. Plenty of other things on. And let's go ahead. And as the monorail is taking us back to the basement, a question. Let's look at a question that somebody has written in with. Oh boy, oh boy, Andy. He says he got to see this silly little movie I was in that I can't recommend for everybody. If you like R-rated silliness and a lot of nudity, then you can check out Space Babes from Outer Space. That's right. It's a parody of sort of those late night Cinemax movies, that kind of thing. And it's fun. Some friends of mine made it, and they asked me to play a small role in it, and I did. And it's filthy, and it's childish, but fun, yeah. So if you like that kind of thing, check out Space Babes from Outer Space. You'll have to Google it. I don't remember exactly where it's available right now. But Andy had a really good question. Oh, you know what? He also said he's looking for another movie I was in called The Impersonators. You know, I just found a box of Blu-rays. I've got like 50 copies of The Impersonators, signed copies or whatever. If you're interested in one of these, and Andy, you say you are, send me a message saying you'd like one. They're $20. I'll just send them to you or whatever, and you can Venmo me or something. I don't have them on my website or anything. So if you are interested, we'll work it out. What else? Here's the question. Okay. Andy says, as someone who has had weight issues, for the bulk of his comedy career. Okay, that's me. How pressured do you feel, if at all, to maintain the physical side of your comedy persona? Obviously, you're funny regardless of size, but self-deprecation and continued needling from your coworkers, cough Griswold, are fun elements in your realm. I've no. Let's see. Is as you okay? Yeah, yeah. He's essentially asking, am I afraid to lose weight because it'll make me less funny? That's kind of a gross paraphrasing of what he's asking there. Do I think it will alter? Am I afraid to lose weight because it'll alter my persona? Yes, yes. Now, it's not a strong fear. It's not something that worries me a lot. But there is a little bit of fear there. For anybody who knows a little bit about comedy and comedians and how they operate and what the job requires and stuff like that, you'll know, and if not, you're going to learn right now, that writing material for a comedian is it's a long process. So, when you watch, let's say, a comedian on a late-night talk show and they do 6 or 7 minutes of stand-up, it has taken them a very, very long time to develop that material and to perfect it and to get it ready for that show or, you know, stage, whatever. One does not write a joke, and rarely do you write a joke and it's like, it's done. So you're always honing it and rewriting and cutting and adding and everything. So I have probably over the years, I have about, I'd say at least 10 minutes out of a 50 minute set that is about me being overweight. And it might even be a little bit more than 10 minutes, actually. And those bits tend to work. They tend to get a lot of laughs. So if all of a sudden, well, if over a half a year or a year, whatever, I drop 60, 70 pounds, I lose that 10 minutes of material because nobody, I think,
Nobody wants to watch a person in shape talk about, do a bunch of fat jokes. I mean, what am I going to do? Go, yeah, when I was overweight. I mean, I guess it could. There's a chance it would work, but it's just not going to work as well. Something, there's going to be something weird about it. At least I'm assuming, you know. So yes, there is that fear of, man, I'm going to lose some good jokes and I'm going to lose some time. But that said, I can always fill in that 10 or 15 minutes with new material, you know, which is what a comedian should be doing anyway. Moving some things out of their set and putting new things in and keeping it, you know, having some nice turnover in your act. There is something to be said for the persona, though, as well. And that's also something that I have to kind of consider in just real life, off stage and off the air, of is it going to change who I am in the eyes of my friends, family, stuff like that? What's going to change? So I think that's why losing weight is more than just about diet and exercise. There are real psychological and emotional things going on as well. It's probably hard for somebody who's never been overweight to understand. You just eat less and you work out and you eat better. And what could there mentally be? You're gonna feel great, and you're not gonna, you know, you'll be less self-conscious. So it's all positive. Yeah, but there's usually some underlying thing as well. So that needs to be addressed at the same time. And I can do that. I've got plenty of friends and family. I see a therapist. So, yes, I mean, addressing those things while doing, you know, dieting and exercise and stuff like that will absolutely help. I think that's why a lot of people who go on like The Biggest Loser and stuff, you'll later read, you know, 6 months or a year down the line, it's like, well, they gained all their weight back. Well, of course. I never watched that show, so I may be wrong here, but I don't think... I'm assuming they didn't do enough to prepare that person psychologically and emotionally for going from 500 pounds to 180 pounds and how what a change that is. That, I mean, and what that did for their persona, how they were seen, how they were treated, all that stuff. There's a lot going on there. So do I have that fear? Yes. Is it going to keep me from getting into better shape? You know, to a certain extent it has, but for me, it's a pretty small percentage of the whole pie. Oh, I see what you did there, Josh. That's not what I was doing. But it's a, for me, I think it's something else. Not so much fear as, well, I don't know. Maybe there's, that's something for me to address. every other Monday at 11 a.m. So great question. That's a very, that's a very good and astute question and a thoughtful one. So thank you for that. The long and short of it is, do I worry about losing my 10 to 15 minutes of fat jokes, self-deprecating fat jokes? I do. Do I think that I could gain 10 to 15 minutes of jokes about dieting and working out and being a new person and getting in better shape? And so, yes. So I do have faith that I can come up with some equally funny stuff. I guess that's the answer. Thank you for that question, Andy. And oh, my gosh, you're also known as... Interred Ferguson. Yes, I've seen your Instagrams and stuff, and yeah, okay. Thank you very much for writing. Okay, that was the question. Where did we leave off last week? I'm sure I was blabbing on about my time with Rawlings, and I think when we last stopped chatting about it, I was on the road in a gigantic moving truck, a manual moving truck that had a governor on it at 55, set at 55 miles per hour. So I was slowly making my way around the country with boxes and boxes and boxes of Gardetto snack mix and Wheaties Energy Crunch. Well, as you, if you remember, my coworker Mike and I were assigned to hand out these samples at most of the Major League Baseball stadiums in the country. But my immediate supervisor and a higher up at Rawlings did not attain permission from these stadiums. And when we tried to, Mike and I, we were often met with, no way in hell can you do that. Or we just never got our phone calls returned or any or emails returned or anything like that. But they sent us out anyway. So here's what started happening. We would arrive at a Major League Baseball stadium with this branded Rawlings Suburban, meaning it was wrapped in graphics that said Rawlings all over it and had some Major League players on it and all this stuff, and a gigantic moving truck. Now, this was in the summer of 2000. So this was pre-9/11, which is important because I apologize. This was the summer of 2001. And so in May, June, July of 2001, we were able to pull up with a gigantic moving truck and not really raise any red flags. Whereas post 9/11, of course, I mean, look, everything, and rightfully so, became pretty locked down. You had to, you just couldn't show up with a giant truck and park it next to a stadium. I mean, it was nuts. And by nuts, I mean, we shouldn't have been able to do that before 9/11. we would pull up and get out. We would stand by the Suburban and break out some of the boxes of samples and start handing them out. Well, people would take them, of course. Why not have some free samples, especially if something that people like? And they would take bags. Now, we were told one bag and one tiny box of Wheaties Energy Crunch per person, which makes sense. But that is not what ended up happening later on in the summer, because so many times we would show up at these stadiums and without permission, as we were directed to do by my bosses, without permission, start handing these things out, and we would be chased away by the folks who work at the stadium, and they would be really upset, and rightfully so. Who the hell? What is this about? That kind of thing. So we would end up only being able to pass out like maybe, I'll put it in time increments, like for 5 minutes or 10 minutes before somebody from the stadium would walk out and go, what the hell are you guys doing? Oh, we're with Rawlings and we're doing this co-op with General Mills. Who? What? You can't do this. And I remember learning from many of these different stadium employees, they would come out and go, you're going to get us sued. We have distribution companies that we have deals with. And if we have any other kind of food being handed out here, we can be in breach of contract. You have to leave. So we would be chased away. And this happened time and time again. Now, there were times where we'd pull up to a stadium and we were able to pass out. Nobody said anything to us. And we were able to do it before the game and after the game. Now, there was no reason to really pass anything out during the game. So what Mike and I would do is buy a ticket and go into the game. So I got to see quite a few. And even after we were like shut down many of those times, well, what are we going to do? They just screamed at us. They said, we can't go. We can't pass out samples. We have to shut everything down. We would go park the vehicles and we'd walk back or whatever. And we would buy a ticket and go. That way we could see a game in all these different ballparks. So I ended up watching Major League Baseball games in I think all Major League Baseball stadiums except for like six. And now that list is probably to like 10 or 12 because of new stadiums. Like, I got to, you know, I saw a game in Cincinnati, but that stadium no longer is standing. There's a new one, and I have yet to see a game there, that kind of thing. So, pretty lucky, you know, that I got to go to these all these games and watch some good baseball, see a lot of great players, and experience all those great stadiums. But the job itself turned out to be a total joke. It was ridiculous. We couldn't get our job done because I really do blame my supervisors for this. They didn't think it through. They didn't get permission. And I am still pretty annoyed that they put us in that situation. What we should have done, and this would have been completely immoral and unethical and everything, what we should have done, because we carried this out. We carried the project through the whole summer, driving from city to city to city. Our first leg was the whole West Coast. And then came back to St. Louis in the middle of the summer. The All-Star game that year was in Seattle. So we stopped in Seattle. Or, you know, we spent a week in Seattle. And we were able to pass out there because we were part of, you know what? We weren't. We had to, like, secretly do it. This was all such horse crap. It was just an awful, like, I was really lucky in that I got to go all these places and see all this stuff. But it was also a total, like, we were kind of living in fear a lot of the times because we didn't know when we were going to get in trouble and how much trouble we were going to get into for trying to do our jobs. So anyway, we had this long West Coast. After the All-Star break, we then went to the East Coast and we did the whole East Coast and stuff like that. So what I'm saying, what I was trying to say here is what we should have done was abandoned that moving truck filled with all the samples and just said we were doing it, and Mike and I should have taken the Suburban around the country and just gone to all those baseball games because we couldn't get it done anyway. So I should have just been calling my boss going, yeah, it's going great, and dumping those samples into a river somewhere. Because what would happen is when we started, and my gosh, if people at General Mills and or Rawlings heard this, they would be unhappy. But I'm telling you, this is the position that they put us, not that General Mills put us in. I think that in some ways they were fed a line. But Rawlings put us in this position because they didn't. They started a program that they had no idea if they could do or not. They, I should have been calling and saying, it's going, I mean, man. Sorry, I just got so bent out of shape that I forgot my point. anyway, we should have. Here was my point. What started happening was the stadiums where we weren't getting yelled at and chased away, we started giving people boxes of these things. So instead of giving a one bag to one person, we were opening up the back of that moving truck because we also were going to get a bonus if we passed all these things out. Not only were we going to get a bonus, Rawlings was going to get some kind of, they were going to get more money from the co-op, from General Mills, I was told. So, and Mike and I were going to get a bonus if we did. We would give a box to a person. So in a box, no less than 250 tiny bags of Gardettos or 100 little boxes of Wheaties Energy Crunch. So we'd go, here, take a case. We were just handing cases to people. And did we do a good job? No, technically no. But was it what we were sort of put in a position to do? I would argue yes. Shy of throwing all that stuff into a ditch or off a cliff or something. Total pain. So were there good times? Of course. Mike and I would go to we would sightsee on our days off. We would go to cool restaurants. We would go to concerts and movies and bars. And we did have some laughs. There were days where we hated each other. I think there were more days where he hated me than I hated him. Because I took it a little, like, you can hear it in my voice now. I'm getting bent out of shape just talking about it. Think of how I was when I was actually in the position. I mean, I was more bent out of shape, so I wasn't always the happiest guy to be around. But we did have some laughs.
Not enough, though, because I haven't talked to the guy since we stopped, since this job stopped. So since like the winter of 2001 or whatever, we never spoke again. But I hope he's doing well. He was a good dude. He was really funny. And he introduced me to some of my favorite music. Modest Mouse and Built to Spill and a lot of punk bands that I really like, Bouncing Souls and stuff like that. I really love. He was the one who introduced me to them. So we did have some really good times, but we also had some terrible, terrible times. One trip in particular was really, really rough. So at the time, I also had a girlfriend. She worked at Rawlings, and I think it is safe to say that we were in love, and we were talking like about how we were going to spend the rest of our lives together, that kind of thing. And she was, 9 years older than me, 8 years older. So I was, 2001, I would have been 22? No, no, no. 23. I was 23, and she was 29. So it was 6 years difference. She was 29 and then 30 and whatever. Well, yes, Josh, that's how aging works. All right. So, so she was a little older, but man, we really dug each other. And I was, missing her and stuff like that. After the All-Star break in Seattle, we had to go back to St. Louis to reload the moving truck and then start our East Coast tour. So let's say, I don't have the specific dates correct here, but let's say the last day that we were in Seattle for All-Star Week was July 15th. Well, we had to be in like Cleveland or something July 19th. So I had 4 days off essentially. But what that meant was I had 4 days to drive from Seattle to St. Louis, to Cleveland. So I was going to have, I kind of did the math in my head or whatever. If I drove 12 hours a day, it would take me 3 days to get to St. Louis because it was 36 hours from Seattle to St. Louis. So if I drove 12 hours a day, again, in a giant manual moving truck with a governor of 55 miles per hour, I could do it. And it was, get to spend a night with my girlfriend before I had to leave the next day for another, 8 weeks or whatever. So I did it. I drove from Seattle the first day, 12 hours, and it was hard, but also really beautiful. I got to drive through Montana and Wyoming and all these other, those 3 days, I saw some beautiful, beautiful parts of the country. Now, some of it was scary because there are some mountainous areas and really hilly roads. And in that moving truck, it wasn't always fun. And, but man, just gorgeous country. So on day three, I'm going through Nebraska and I'm going through, Iowa. So I go through Omaha and Council Bluffs, Iowa. And then I'm driving. Finally, I get to Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm 4 hours away from St. Louis. And I'm 4 hours from seeing my girlfriend who I love, who I haven't seen in weeks. And we're going to spend the night together get to see each other in the morning. And man, oh man, just so excited to be back with her. She was like one of my, we were really into each other and laughed a lot and had a lot of same interests and all this stuff. So I'm driving through Kansas City and the truck breaks down. The truck breaks down in the evening of that third day. I'm supposed to be, had the truck not broken down, I would have been back in St. Louis for dinner, essentially. So I guess it was really early afternoon. It was early afternoon that it broke down in Kansas City. And I was going to be there for dinner. And I think she was a good cook. And so she was like making something we both loved and whatever. So the truck breaks down on the side of the road. And I call a company, some mechanics or whatever. And they tell me It's going to be a while, but they're going to come out and get me. Well, it took them 4 hours. It took them 4 hours to come get me. It took me the amount of time it would have taken me to get to St. Louis. So when they showed up, I would have been in St. Louis already. So they show up and look at the truck, and it comes to find out I ran out of gas. Well, how did you not know you ran out of gas? Well, what happened was, I think I explained in an earlier podcast that this moving truck had dual tanks. There was a diesel tank on either side. So underneath the driver's side and underneath the passenger side. Something happened to where the first tank emptied. So the reserve tank should have taken over. Gas should have started being taken from that. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't being taken from that. So I didn't technically run out of gas. There was some problem with the two tanks. And so what I had to do, they had to give me a little bit of gas. And it took a lot. Like, it took a lot of work to fire that baby up after running out of gas. And then I had to go like a mile down the road to a truck stop and fill up the rest of the way. So that, it was just like, my God. So finally I get to St. Louis at like 10. It's way late. She has to work the next day. And we get to spend a couple hours, you know, waking hours. I'm beat. I had just driven 36 hours, 40 if you count the breakdown, in 3 days, and was exhausted mentally and physically. But I remember we had a nice night, and then the next day I saw her at work, and I had to leave again. So then we did the East Coast part of the tour, and we met with just as much with just as many problems as we did on the West Coast. The stadiums didn't want us there. We couldn't be there. We couldn't. What were we going to do with all these samples? Give cases away to anybody who would take them. That's what we did. Also, what we would do, and again, not proud of this, but this is what we did. We would unload a truck. So let's say we'd pull up to a stadium or whatever. We would unload 20 cases of samples. And set them by the Suburban, and then people would come by, and we would hand out the samples from those cases. Whatever we didn't pass out, let's say we only passed out 5 cases total, and we still had 15 cases there, we just left. We didn't put them back in the truck and leave. We said, see ya, and took off. So many of those either were taken by somebody else or thrown away or left to disintegrate in the rain. Who knows? Not proud of it, but felt like I was justified because of the situation. Now I know what I should have done was told my supervisors very, very early, like way earlier on, hey, this isn't working. We are coming home. That kind of thing. That's what I should have done. We're bringing all this back. Ship it back to General Mills. This isn't going to happen. You guys had your heads up your asses when you conceived this idea, and we're not doing it. But I wanted to work for Rawlings, you know? And we were young in our 20s, seeing the country. So, not proud of everything that was done on that trip, but particularly not proud of the job we were given. Now, a couple interesting things did happen out there on the road. One in particular was we went to New York City, and we were to go to see the Mets and the Yankees, and that meant that I had to drive this gigantic truck through New York City, and boy, was that exciting. I mean, you know, if you've ever driven a car in New York, you know how difficult it is. So driving this truck and trying to find a place to park it,
impossible. I mean, just nearly impossible. But what I soon realized was that when you're in a truck in New York City, you just drive and everyone else needs to just get out of your way. So I just drove. Now, I remember in particular, one, we were leaving New York City. And man, I don't remember honestly how it went. I don't remember if we were able to pass out. I think we did okay. Like, we were able to pass stuff out at the Mets, but not the Yankees, something like that. Who knows? So we we decide we're done with New York City. Of course, we have to leave. And it was kind of one of our last stops anyway on that East Coast tour. And so we are leaving. And as I'm on one of the main interstates going through New York, this 18-wheeler is a little too in my lane as he's trying to pass me. He's coming up from behind and he's flying and he knocks my driver's side mirror off. I mean, I don't know if his mirror hit my mirror or whatever, but it scared the hell out of me. The mirror comes flying off and it was really loud and just scary. And I went, oh my God. And I remember looking out the window, the mirror's gone. The mirror is now gone. And my gosh, that could have been terrible. If he had been another inch or so closer, we may have, I don't know. Who knows? And so I was, you know, nervous and scared. And then I drove a little bit more and I saw the city. I saw like almost all of New York City. And it was beautiful. It was at night and everything was lit up. And for a long time, and obviously I'm looking at the road and I'm still nervous and stuff. But when I can, I'm glancing and I'm just in awe at the skyline and some of the architecture. And I'm looking for the Chrysler building because this may seem like a weird thing to say, but it's my favorite building. I think the architecture and the style and the design of the Chrysler building is just stunning. And so I always like to keep an eye out for that. And then I see the World Trade Center and I'm just, my gosh, what a marvel of engineering and what those represent and how incredible they are. And I remember going, oh yeah, those towers, I was at the top of one of those towers when my show choir in high school visited New York and performed in New York City. We went to the top of the World Trade Center and I remember I was having memories of looking out the windows at the top of it and the elevator ride up and laughing with friends and, you know, that and some of my friends being nervous to get close to the window and then also standing at the bottom of the World Trade Center and leaning against it with my back up to it and then tilting my head up and staring all the way up at it and just going, my goodness, those buildings are incredible. And that night, as I was admiring the Twin Towers, was September 9th, 2011. And by the night of September 10th, I was back in St. Louis at my girlfriend's house. And I got to spend the night there with her. And the next morning, we woke up and had a very nice morning. She got ready for work and she headed into work. And I was headed to go see my dad, who lived, you know what? No, I wasn't. I apologize. I was headed home to my apartment. And so this was about 7:20 a.m. on September 11th. 2001. I may have said 2011 earlier. I apologize. It was September 9th, 2001 that I was driving through New York City. And so on September 11th, 2001, I left my girlfriend's house and being the giant fan of the show that I was and am, I turned on Bob and Tom. They were on Casey in St. Louis. And I'm listening and I remember distinctly Tom saying, hey, we've got a report here about a small biplane or some kind of small passenger having hit the World Trade Center. I can't remember if they said personal aircraft or small passenger plane or something, But it was before anybody really had the full news. And I was saying, oh my gosh, that's weird. And then, you know, they kind of continued on with the show. And then either Tom or Bob said, well, some more news here. A second plane has hit the second tower, the other World Trade Center tower. And things were obviously more, it became very clear that this was very serious and a planned attack. So I went, oh my goodness. And I altered my girlfriend lived fairly close to the house I grew up in where my dad still lived. So instead of going home, I wanted to see what was going on. So I went to my dad's and he was still asleep. And I turned the TV on and was watching the news. And my gosh, there they were, the two towers smoking. We all remember those black plumes coming from the tops of the towers. And I woke my dad up. I said, Dad, we're under there's a terrorist attack. America's being attacked. And he said, what? And he got up. And then for the rest of the morning, we watched the news together. And I mean, we're heartbroken. We watched everything. And I remember watching Wolf Blitzer at the top of a building and the Twin Towers were in the back. And I mean, my dad and I watched them fall. And obviously the first one and then the second. And we watched people in the streets covered in soot. And, well, I don't need to get into too many specifics because we, you know, for the most part, we all remember it. If you're too young to remember it, you've certainly seen images and footage from that day. And it occurred to me, Mike, I was there. I was there 2 days ago. And I was just looking at those and admiring them and in awe of them. And now they are gone. And obviously, I'm not just talking about the buildings themselves. You know, the buildings in the scheme of things, some concrete really doesn't matter. But it was just, and my dad had to go. I also remember he had to go pick up a prescription from the grocery store and he needed it. And so we left at around, I don't know. We left and we were listening to Bob and Tom again, who I tell you what, I've heard that they received a lot of praise for how they handled that morning. And I got to tell you, it was masterful. Masterful how they did it, how they were able to, just the professionalism and the care that Bob and Tom and the whole crew and everybody took to stay with everybody during that time and to explain what was happening and incredible journalism and radio and they really did a fine job. And my dad and I got to the grocery store and we walked in and it was surreal. First off, it was nearly empty and the folks that were in there were very, very pensive and quiet, and everybody was sort of just shuffling around getting what they were there for. But eerie. So I dropped my dad back off at the house and spent a little time with him. I mean, this is a man that, you know, fought for his country in Vietnam and certainly knew a lot about sacrifice was also very, he wasn't a pacifist at the end of his life, but he was certainly like, hey, there are probably better ways than war to try to figure some things out, stuff like that, because he had seen the horse. So he was affected, of course, and I was affected as well. And then I was affected by him being affected and, you know. So anyway, I drop him off and I go back to my apartment and I don't know what I did. I think I prepared for, we still had more places to go on the disaster sample tour that I was on. And I may have been doing laundry or packing or something. But that night I was going back to my girlfriend's house and the whole day of emotion and
and horror and everything. Because if you remember, we didn't know when it was going to stop. The towers are hit. The Pentagon's hit. There's a plane crash in Pennsylvania. I mean, and there was a lot of speculation about other things happening that day. Where's the next one going to be? Oh, something exploded in here. Oh, no, that turned out to be a different incident. That kind of, I mean, it was, we just didn't know. There was a lot of fear and a lot of sadness going on. And so I'm heading back to my girlfriend's house around 5 or 6 o'clock for dinner. And I'll never forget driving by a gas station. And there were no less. A gas station that normally you would look and never see every pump full. There was always two or three cars getting gas at one time at like a 10-pump station. Well, this station, every pump was full, and there was a line of cars waiting to get gas, 30 deep, 40 deep. And I looked, and gas was $5 a gallon when that morning earlier, it was a dollar something or two, you know, because all of a sudden there was fear that, okay, we're going to go to war with whoever did this to us. Gas prices are going to be affected. And so some price gouging went on, and people thought, well, I better get gas now when it's $5 a gallon before it's $20 a gallon. And I started sobbing because all of it, the whole day, the weight of the day and the real world ramifications came crashing down on top of me. And I just bawled at my gosh, we now live in a new world. And got home, and then my girlfriend got home, and we cried together, and we were just stunned. And please don't be mistaken in that I was not crying about things like gas prices and stuff like that. It was just that moment that really brought it all just came. It all just hit me. I think throughout the day I'd been trying to numb myself kind of or something, you know, you're just sort of in disbelief. And then when I saw that many people in line to get gas, it went, oh, my God, we're all affected in some way or another. This is just a new world. So tough. Boy, I mean, that's an understatement. So, you know, after that, things did change for us. We were not, and rightfully so, we couldn't just drive this truck around in the Suburban around and pull up wherever we wanted and open boxes and start throwing things around, you know. We had to change our game plan because we still had a lot of samples left. So we started going to – I talked to my supervisors, and we got actual permission to go to some state fairs and county fairs and baseball tournaments that weren't affiliated with any big entity like MLB or NCAA or anything like that, and try to pass out the rest of these samples. And also giving some cases to family and friends, we did it. We got rid of we didn't do it in the way that we were meant to, and we didn't always do it in the most appropriate way. But we didn't throw any in a river or a lake. We did give away a lot of boxes to people, but we ended up getting rid of all of the samples. And that was the last time that anything like that was attempted. In fact, the guy who conceived of that idea the next year didn't even work at Rawlings. I don't know why he left or was fired. Or what, I have no idea. But he was not there for much longer at all. And neither was Mike. But I stuck around. And I ended up working on and off for Rawlings Sporting Goods for like 15 years in different capacities. And I'll tell you about those other capacities and some other Rawlings adventures down the road. But that was my first, yeah, the first sort of leg of my career with Rawlings Sporting Goods. All right. You know, there was another quick story when I worked in the mailroom that I'll just tell you right now that got me into a little bit of trouble. Before that whole road thing, I was in the mailroom, and on Halloween, we were told we could dress up in costume. So I thought it would be funny if I dressed up, because I was sort of the errand boy or whatever of the office building, which I liked being, but I thought it would be funny if I dressed up in a French maid's outfit. So I did. Showed up in this very sexy French maid costume and worked all day. And yeah, of course, it got some laughs. And you can actually see this photo on my Instagram, That Josh Arnold. You'll have to scroll a little bit to see it, but it's there. And boy, oh boy. But I did get a talking to, but hey, that really wasn't the most appropriate thing for you to do. All right. Let's see here. What to work on this week? Well, will you look at that? It's, some General Mills employees walking down the street, and hey, what is that they say as they point to 12 cases of their product abandoned in the rain? Oh, man. I don't have anything written out for what to work on this week. Should I make something up on the spot, or should we give ourselves a break this week? What do you think? Huh? You know what? I do have something. It was something I was thinking about today. And it's minor, okay? But it's going to have it has major benefits. Especially this time of year. Drink more water, all right? It may sound like I'm pulling this out of my rear end. I'm not. It's on my mind a lot. Okay, I'm kind of pulling it out of my rear. Drink more water. And do this. Chris, what's the guy's name? Chris Pratt. I was recently quoted. He recently talked about this. And this is something I've done for like the last couple of years. Primarily for my voice. And he does this too now. And he said it just changed his life. And I agree. When you first wake up, drink as much water as you can until you think you might get sick. Now, I would do it because I was going to go on the air soon. So I would wake up, and I always have a water bottle, like this water bottle thing I have, or just a big, big plastic cup of water near my bed. So I would chug that, take a shower. It was like it was at least 24 ounces or whatever of water. Take a shower, go downstairs, chug another one of those, and then get to work and chug a bottle of water. I mean, and just drink the whole thing. So by the time that I was hitting the airwaves at 6, I just wanted to make sure I was lubricated and you know, all that stuff. I would have already had, boy, like 40 plus ounces, if not closer to 50 or 60, you know. So, and what I also found out though was like my body loved it. It loved it. So, and Pratt recently said that he started doing it and his body loved it. And you've seen his body. I mean, if you're gonna take somebody's word for it, go with Pratt's when it comes to the body stuff. But also take my word. I could think clearer and everything. Water is just we take it for granted. And man. Go ahead. This week, drink more water, stay hydrated, and do not forget that when you're drinking water, you need... Bye!
Du bist ein Raider, der sich unter der Erde niedergelassen hat. Doch jetzt musst du an die Oberfläche zurückkehren. Dorthin, wo die Ark-Maschinen umherstreifen. Ist. Wer weiß, was du da oben findest. Ark Raiders. Ein Multiplayer. Multiplayer Extraction Abenteuer Videospiel. Jetzt erhältlich für PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X und S sowie PC.